From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Midtown, San Jose.
19th Avenue, San Francisco.
Excelsior District of San Francisco.
Financial District.
Coming up, how the area is preparing for one of the highest security events the region has ever hosted, Super Bowl 50.
So you'll see officers out there on foot, on bicycles. You'll see our motorcycle officers very busy. Officers in vehicle patrol.
Then we meet a woman whose life's work is helping people talk about abortion rather than debate it.
It is incredibly challenging to hold the space for connection as the times become increasingly polarized.
And we hear how one transgender woman became an activist.
And you have to understand at that time, we had been beaten up, thrown in jail, murdered and raped.
Protecting and supporting each other. That's today on Cross Currents. The teams are decided, the streets are closed, and more than a million people are expected to flood into the Bay Area to celebrate the upcoming Super Bowl. Thousands will attend free events in San Francisco along Market Street and the Embarcadero in the week leading up to the game. 70,000 people are expected to watch the game at Levi's Stadium in Santa Clara a week from Sunday. It's kind of a big deal. The Super Bowl is considered a national special security event. That's a title. It's on par with events like presidential inaugurations, G8 summits, and papal visits. Earlier this month, the FBI issued a memo that said it was concerned about people cutting fiber optic cables around the stadium. It's also concerned about unlicensed drones flying over the game, and so much more. So, ever since Santa Clara won the bid to host the game 2.5 years ago, the region has been planning on how to keep everyone safe. KALW's Angela Johnston reports.
You wouldn't think rain would be high on the list for Super Bowl security threats, but Super Bowl Sunday is historically one of the wettest days in the Bay Area. So during a simulation in the Emergency Operations Center in San Francisco, it's at the top.
It's 9 a.m. Tuesday. Overnight, a huge El Nino storm has brought heavy rain, lightning, and strong winds to the Bay Area.
Francis Zamora rattles off a long list of fake emergencies to a room full of police officers, 911 dispatchers, firemen, and paramedics. They huddle around three big tables, taking notes as Zamora continues with the bad news.
Flooding, erosion, mudslides, and power outages have been reported, and there are more to be expected.
There are three phones on each table, a digital phone, a satellite phone, and a big vintage red telephone. That one is extra important, Zamora tells me. It's a direct line to the mayor's office. It was the only way police were able to reach former Mayor Art Agnos during the 89 earthquake. Zamora keeps reading.
Four electric buses have stalled in the middle of streets, blocking traffic and causing cars to swerve to avoid them.
Zamora is the public information officer for the city's Department of Emergency Management.
We manage the everyday and not so everyday emergencies in San Francisco.
He's organized this training session for the people who'll be staffing the Emergency Operations Center, or the EOC for short, during the 9 days leading up to the Super Bowl. Even though the game is going to be played 40 miles south in Santa Clara, all of the major events, concerts, and parties will be taking place downtown San Francisco at places called Super Bowl City, presented by Verizon, and the NFL Experience, driven by Hyundai. This room will become the central command center for anything that happens in the city that week. It'll be staffed by people from the Transportation Authority, BART, Muni, police and fire departments, the CHP, the FBI.
This is so we're all in one place so we can react to things that may take place, whether they are just minor disruptions which may take place every day in a big city or, something major.
The EOC is preparing for anything and everything. Big traffic accidents, an earthquake, terrorist attacks. They've gone through countless situations. They act out bad days, and they act out good days, too. Because despite hosting the biggest annual event in the United States, the police and fire departments will also be operating as usual. They're bringing in enough extra personnel to ensure normal staffing at every station across the city.
We want to make sure that the entire city is covered. So if you need help in the Richmond District or in the Sunset or in Mira Loma Park, you can still get help.
This isn't the first time the EOC has been activated.
A great example is during the 2010 World Series parade.
The San Francisco Giants had just won their first World Series. More than a million people came into the city to celebrate. Officials blocked off Market Street, and ambulances were having trouble getting to hospitals around the city. So they turned to the EOC for a solution.
It was great to have a representative from MTA in the room to say, hey, and police in the room saying, hey, we need to clear out Mission Street so we can get traffic moving, that we can get, you know, emergency vehicles to, have clear access where they need to go.
The location of the EOC is key. It's just northwest of the Civic Center on the first floor of a big gray building. The city's 911 dispatch center is upstairs.
San Francisco 911. Okay, go ahead with the address. Can you confirm that address, please?
And right down the hall is the citywide warning siren. People staffing the EOC during the week of the Super Bowl are trained to operate the siren in case of a real emergency. San Francisco is spending almost $5 million to host the Super Bowl, but only two city departments allocated spending for the event in their budgets for this year. The Department of Emergency Management, where we're at right now, and the Fire Department. The Police Department did not, yet they estimate they'll spend $1.5 million.
You're going to see an increased police presence downtown?
That's Michael Andrzejczyk. He's the Public Information Officer for the SFPD.
So you'll see officers out there on foot, on bicycles. You'll see our motorcycle officers very busy, officers in vehicle patrol. There will be some plainclothes officers that you probably won't see, and that's the idea.
Andrzejczyk says officers won't be allowed to take days off during the 9 days leading up to the Super Bowl. There'll be bag checks and metal detectors at most events. You'll see officers on buses and subways with police dogs, more police at the airport. But they can't say much more.
So that if somebody was planning to do something harmful, we don't want them to know how many officers they might encounter or not encounter, or if they'll be in uniform or play clothes, or where they're going to be.
The San Francisco Police Department is also closely working with the Santa Clara Police Department, which is the lead law enforcement agency for the Super Bowl. Back in November, it organized a full-blown five-hour simulation at Levi's Stadium with bomb squads, SWAT teams, and helicopters. And it set up its own emergency operations center for game day. Santa Clara Police Officer Kirk Clark is in charge.
And we have a robust plan, and security will be visible, and it will be a safe Super Bowl.
Clark and his team went to the site of last year's Super Bowl to see how law enforcement took care of business. The big game was held in suburban Glendale, Arizona. The parties took place in Phoenix. Clark's main takeaway?
What I saw in Arizona was folks will go to the Super Bowl even if they don't have a ticket.
Just to check out the stadium or to take a selfie in front of it. This year, it'll be different. The perimeter of the stadium will be closed off to anyone without a ticket.
The footprint's really tight around the stadium. It will be locked down so many feet. So please do not come to the stadium. Find a good spot, watch a game, and enjoy it, because you'll just be caught in traffic or be turned around or wind up in a road closure somewhere and might get lost.
Around that footprint, police and FBI will be patrolling the stadium looking for sex traffickers, counterfeit tickets, and fake NFL apparel. Those may not be the biggest public safety concerns during Super Bowl week, but law enforcement down here and back up in San Francisco's Emergency Operations Center are trying to look at every angle.
The California Highway Patrol has issued wind advisories on all Bay Area bridges. The three middle lanes of the Golden Gate Bridge have been turned into a buffer zone in case cars get in the rain.
Here in the EOC, there are big posters duct taped to the walls. They have blank columns. Above them, the words estimated fatalities and confirmed fatalities.
PG&E is reporting power outages affecting 30,000 customers in San Francisco, with more expected. So in the next 5 minutes,
giant digital clocks hang on the walls, counting milliseconds in neon yellow numbers. Zamora says everyone will have 5 minutes to craft a note to send out to the public on the city's text message alert system.
Write this like you're writing for a third grader, okay? Because we want to make sure that the messages are clear, but also there are a lot of people here in the city and in the country that, you know, may speak a different language.
It's intense now, but when the Super Bowl ends, the Emergency Operations Center will close. It'll stay empty until there's an emergency or until the city hosts another huge event. there could be another World Series parade, for example. After all, it's an even year. For Cross Currents, I'm Angela Johnston.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. It takes a lot of special security to keep those who attend the big game safe. But the Super Bowl only happens once a year. Other support needs to be offered on a more daily basis. Aspen Baker is on a mission to do just that, by helping people listen to each other. She's the founder of Exhale, an Oakland-based nonprofit she started in 2000 after she had an abortion. Baker grew up in a born-again Christian family. Abortion wasn't something she ever thought would happen to her, until it did. And once she started talking about it, she discovered something that surprised her even more, how common it was. But for something that happens to so many people, talking about abortion is anything but commonplace. Rather than dialogue, we more often have debate, a shouting match where nobody really gets heard. And that got Baker thinking and writing. Her new book, Pro Voice, How to Keep Listening When the World Wants a Fight, lays out a strategy to help people connect in the face of all kinds of divisive issues. She came to KALW Studios and started by telling me how her personal experience with abortion changed her perspective.
I had just graduated from college. I graduated from UC Berkeley, and a couple short months afterwards, I found out I was pregnant. And at the time, I thought that meant I was going to be a mom. That's what happens when you get pregnant. You become a mom. And over a couple of weeks, I realized that probably wasn't going to be the best choice for me. So I ended up having an abortion. And afterwards, I expected that there would be some kind of support, that somebody would hand me a phone number or a brochure or a book and say, here's a place of other women that you can go and talk to about your abortion experience. And I didn't get any of that. It wasn't offered. So I went looking for it, mostly in the Yellow Pages at the time. And I did find a lot of post-abortion support. It was all Christian or Catholic-based, religious-based. And a lot of it existed in local churches. And, and it was mostly for women who felt regret about their abortions and who needed to seek forgiveness from God. And that wasn't what I was looking for. And so that started the process to start something. And the thing that we started was a non-judgmental talk line for people who'd experienced abortion to call and get non-judgmental emotional support and respect, free from politics, and yet absolutely rooted in whatever spiritual religious practice they were bringing to their abortion experience, that we were open and available to hear about that too.
And so you mentioned that in the past it's been kind of focused on the church and guilt.
Yeah.
And so then what do you offer? What when I make that call, what do I hear on the other side?
So the first thing that we usually do is just ask open-ended questions, you know, to let someone speak for themselves so that we don't have any preconceived notions about whether the caller's experience was a good one or a bad one or the right one or the wrong one. You know, we want to hear what that woman has to say about her own experience. So we use open-ended questions to let her tell her story the way that she wants.
Like what?
You know, how did that feel for you? What was that like? And we do a lot of validating. So that's the first thing, is we validate whatever emotions someone says. So if they say, I'm feeling really sad, we say, I hear that. Sounds really common. I think a lot of women have felt really sad. Or someone says, wow, I feel so much better. I was so freaked out thinking about what it was going to be like to have a kid. And now that weight is lifted off my shoulder. And we say, wow, that's awesome. Look at you. You know, look at you make this decision for yourself.
There's no advice really given. Oh, you should do this. Oh, you should not do that. That's not part of this project.
We believe that people have their own best answers. And so maybe the next thing that we do after we, you know, learn a little bit more about what it's like for them, after we validate their feelings, after we make sure we use the language that they use. So we use reflective language.
Tell me about that.
So if someone
reflective language,
reflective
what does that
language
mean?
It means that if someone calls it a baby, that we'll call it a baby. It means if someone calls it a fetus, we call it a fetus. It means if someone talks about the Lord, we'll talk about the Lord. It means if somebody talks about being spiritual, we're going to say spiritual. If someone says they're black, we're going to say black. You know, we're not going to reframe language to African-American or God instead of the Lord, or we're going to use the words that they use to describe their own experience.
And what does that do?
It tells them that we're paying attention to what they're saying. Hmm.
I'm talking with Aspen Baker. She is founder and executive director of Exhale and author of the book Pro Voice, How to Keep Listening When the World Wants a Fight. And so a lot of your focus has been, let us change the conversation about abortion from kind of the polarizing conversation mm-hmm. that is happening right now, pro-life, pro-choice, mm-hmm. to a term that you coined, pro-voice.
Pro-voice.
What does that mean?
Pro-voice is that all these things that I'm talking about that we do on the talk line is a way to really listen and engage with people who may have very different experiences. You know, talking to a caller about her abortion, their experience might be very different from mine, but we can engage in a conversation that's respectful and supportive. And that is a thing that a lot more people can do and should be doing. And so Pro Voice grew out of that work in the talk line and then has been transferred into, you know, real life conversations with friends and family, that we have used Pro Voice in conversations with college students and at churches. And it is a way to open up conversations about things that we typically think are very difficult to talk about or off topic, or that make us really nervous, or that make us think that we're going to get into a big fight and we don't know how to do it in a different kind of way. And so the listening is a really key part of that. Storytelling, speaking from personal experience. We tend to get into big rational, logical sort of debates when things get really big and full of conflict, that if we can rationalize our sort of way into a solution. And we think that we need to really start by speaking openly and personally about how the issue affects us and our own lived experience. And that's where the connection can get created, that we need to hold on to in all kinds of conversations.
And so the essence of Pro Voice then is to be able to talk whatever your experience is, and on the other line you will not get someone judgmental or on either side of this spectrum.
It's a way to hold both your own personal political views. So I think that's important to realize about Pro Voice, isn't saying you shouldn't be pro-choice or you shouldn't be pro-life, you should just, you know, be whatever. It's like you can hold your own strong political and personal views and have some skills and some tools that allow you to be in conversations with people who aren't exactly like you or who don't think exactly like you.
So you're going up against this culture, though, which is now very, very strong, this pro-life versus pro-choice, and you have to be either or, and that's where we are right now.
Yeah.
How what are you doing to try to achieve what you're trying to do when you might be the minority in this conversation?
It is incredibly challenging to hold the space for connection as the times become increasingly polarized. And it can be easy to think that, you know, all is lost. Mm-hmm. And that it's getting worse. And that may be true. And part of my job and part of the job of Exhale is to hold out hope for a different kind of future and to help uplift what we would call hidden stories. Mm. So it's not true that this entire country is polarized and divided over everything. That there are families who have Republicans and Democrats in them. There are couples who are pro-choice and pro-life. There are lots and lots of stories of people who are finding ways to stay connected even across their differences. And those stories need to be shared and uplifted and brought to the forefront so that we know what that looks like.
Mm-hmm.
That was Aspen Baker, author of Pro Voice, How to Keep Listening When the World Wants a Fight. More details are at kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. And now it's time for your stories. This is San Francisco StoryCorps. In the 1960s, the Tenderloin District was a center for the LGBT community in San Francisco. But even there, they faced discrimination and harassment, often from the police. Felicia Elizondo first came to the Tenderloin from San Jose as a teenager in 1963. It was there that she took part in the Compton's Cafeteria Riot, one of the first transgender riots in the country in 1966. Elizondo, now age 69, calls herself, quote, a screaming queen, a pioneer, icon, legend, and a diva. In the San Francisco StoryCorps booth, Elizondo talks about the path that led her to become an LGBT activist. And a note to our listeners, this story does contain mature content. You may not want young children listening for the next 4 minutes.
I came with a one wig, a blue dress, and shoes. And that was my initiation to being a female impersonator prostitute. Of course, I was scared. You didn't know who was going to pick you up. And you have to understand, at that time, we had been beaten up, thrown in jail, arrested for obstructing a sidewalk, murdered and raped. They took me to jail for standing on the corner and soliciting five undercover cops for prostitution. I was drunk and I had just taken a pill, and I felt very, very bold. So I propositioned five guys to come to bed with me, and they were all cops. So they got me for five counts of prostitution. But you know something, it wasn't like bad, because the next day you go to court and they would just throw it out. I did get raped one time before my transition in 1973 or 72. I came to San Francisco to party, and I went to the Alley Cat, and this guy asked me to dance, and I wouldn't dance with him. And then he came up to me and got a hold of my arm and pulled back and put his hand over my mouth and dragged me out of the club and took me to my car. And he was telling everybody, "She's my girlfriend. I caught him with somebody, and she's going to pay for it." I guess they called the cops, but they couldn't find us. He hit me. My wig fell off. And he says, "Oh, so you're one of those." He pulled out a knife and was going to kill me. But I said, "I'll do anything for you. I'll do anything you want me to. Just don't do this." And we did our business, and I told him, I begged for my life. And I told him, "I'll give you my phone number, and you don't have to do this to anyone. Call me, and I'll have sex with you. Just don't do this to anyone else." And he let me go. And I thought I was immune to AIDS. Oh, I'm a transsexual woman. How am I going to get infected? No way. Came to San Francisco one night, got drunk, and picked up this cute white boy. Took him home, and I guess that's where I got it. And after I was diagnosed, I didn't think, oh, it was a big surprise. Oh my, how horrible. I think it was given to me because I deserved it, because of all the shit that I had done. But I decided to turn it around. I decided that the best thing for me to do is to educate the lesbian and gay community about our transgender community. A lot of people think that I'm a hero, and I don't think of me as that. I just think that this is the work that I was meant to be, meant to make. I don't want to be remembered. I don't care if they name a street or me. I don't care about anything like that.
That was Felicia Elizondo, an activist for transgender rights. Her interview was produced by Ian Lewis and facilitated by Yosme Del Maso. If you'd like to interview someone in the StoryCorps booth, we'll show you how to reserve your spot at kalw.org. Click on Cross Currents. You can also find us on our new podcast page. And if you have a story idea or comment, email us at news@kalw.org. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Geraldine Asu, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Tammy Drummond, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Casey Miner, and Stephen Short. Today's show is engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Liz Mack. Our managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.